Running a business is hard enough. Don't make it harder with a dozen apps that don't talk to each other. One for sales, another for inventory, a separate one for accounting. That's software overload. Odoo is the all-in-one platform that replaces them all. CRM, accounting, inventory, e-commerce, HR. Fully integrated, easy to use, and built to grow with your business. Thousands have already made the switch. Why not you? Try Odoo for free at odoo.com. That's odoo.com.
Hey, everybody, it's Mark Pattison back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding your way. And this week, we're going to find ourselves talking with a super, super inspirational guy. We'll get to that in just a minute. Before we do that, though, I do want to remind people that I am off to Mount Everest to climb and tackle that big beast. I leave March 30th, and I will need everybody's support, their prayers, and everything else that goes along with that as I try to take on my seventh and final summit of the seventh, all en route to trying to become the first NFL player to climb the seven summits. So there's not that many firsts that are out there, and certainly this will be a big one, a big goal, a big, hairy, audacious goal. I can't wait to get there and go through that. I am going to be putting a link on my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com, where you can actually see through this Garmin app that I have a way that you can track me going up the mountain and down the mountain. And so we'll be doing several spins going up to camp 1, 2, 3, 4, and ultimately the top over a 2-month period. It's going to be a battle going not just for the time that I'm actually on the mountain, but just the mental push of trying to be there without all the modern conveniences of when you're sitting at home and you have a hot shower and those other things. So can't wait to go do that. I just kicked off an amazing event last weekend here in Sun Valley with a lot of notable names like Peter Cetera, the former Chicago frontman, Jim Moore, former NFL coach, and others, and all trying to support and raise money and awareness for a cause that I'm behind called Amelia's Everest. My daughter Amelia has epilepsy, and so we're trying to bring awareness and, as I said, dollars to that cause. We're already over $20,000. We're trying to reach $29,000, which happens to be the height of Mount Everest. So if you want more information about that, again, you can go check out my website, www.markpattisonnfl.com. Okay, so I want to kick off the pod with a something that I was looking through. It's something that spoke to me. And the reason why most people give up so fast is that they look at how far they still have to go instead of how far they've come. And I think this sums up with my guest today, Jason Schechterly. you know, I'm skipping around and bouncing on your last name a little bit. You've got a lot of letters in there. But anyways, first of all, Jason, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, so I'm beaming all the way from Sun Valley, Idaho. I know you're there in Phoenix, Arizona. My sense is I've got a lot of snow on the ground here, and you probably have around 80 or 90 degrees, you know, there in the desert.
Yeah, we got nothing but sunshine. It's probably in the high 60s today, but high 60s in Phoenix feels pretty chilly because we're all so acclimated. We act like, you know, it's the frozen tundra. It's kind of hilarious, and I know it's a lot colder where you're at.
Yeah, so what I want to do is I want to go to March 26th, 2001, and I want to kind of just talk about all the events that led up. And for everybody that's just tuning in right now and listening, this is going to be something that will blow your mind away. The story that another friend, Pete A. Turner, he's got a great podcast, had referred me to Jason and said, you've got to talk to this guy. He's so inspirational. You know, talk about a fighter and not giving up. And really, you know, we talked about the quote to start the show, like how far you've come, and yet, you know, it seems like a long way, but you've done so much just to get where you are today and now speaking to people all over the country. But go back to March 26, 2001, and tell us what happened, what you're doing, your occupation, and what led to really a major mega transformation in your life.
March 26, 2001, I was just Jason, 28 years old, looking back on it, just a perfect life, great family, parents that were healthy and married, all four grandparents alive, siblings, my own kind of growing new family, wife and two kids at the time. And 2 years prior to that, I had had one of my two aha moments in life in wanting to become a Phoenix police officer, born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona. And so at 28 years old, that's what I was doing. Had been doing it for 14 months. And on March 26th of 01, I went to work that day, like we all do every day, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And
hold on before you get to that moment, because you said there were two aha moments. And I didn't get what both those two aha moments were.
Well, the first aha moment had to do with, believe it or not, 2 years to the day before what we're talking about. On March 26th of 1999, a Phoenix police officer named Mark Atkinson was shot and killed in the line of duty. And I was working as an apprentice lineman at the time. Great job, great company here in Arizona, great life going. And as soon as I saw on the news that he had been shot and killed in the line of duty, it was life-changing. I knew right then, right there, I got to be wearing that uniform. I got to be doing his job. And so I went the very next day, filled out an application for the city of Phoenix, and that took me through to becoming a police officer. My second aha moment came many years later and is why I do what I do now. So I'm sure we can get to that.
We'll get to that in a moment. But I'm wondering why, you know, and it's interesting because I know there have been other people. There's a former NFL player, I'm spacing on his name, the guy that played at Arizona State. They've got a statue in front of the stadium. But, you know,
Pep Tillman,
yeah. And I read his book, an amazing book. But here's a guy that played in the NFL, great college football player, great NFL player.
Yes.
And he had, you know, his career was like on fire and he was about to get a new contract. And then the Twin Towers happened. And then he just felt this major calling to quit the NFL and enlist, in which he did. And ultimately he was killed by friendly fire and just this whole drama behind it. But, yes. You know, what was that thing behind for you where somebody dies, and because somebody dies in the line of duty as a police officer in the Phoenix area, that compels you enough that you want to drop everything you're doing and go commit and dedicate your life into that field?
Well, I think I've always been inclined to a call to service. I joined the Air Force out of high school, did my 4 years, really loved it. It gave me exactly what I needed in life, a little structure, a little discipline. I was very proud to have served and in the places that I did. And when I came home at 22 years old, I wanted to be a cop, but at the time I was very immature. And, you know, being a police officer is not, you don't just show up and say, okay, this is what I want. It's a difficult job to get, as it should be. You got to go through a lot of physical, mental testing and find out if you're able to do it. And at that young age, again, maybe some immaturity, I wasn't successful the first couple of times I took the test. And just kind of thought, well, it wasn't, you know, it's not meant to be, and no big deal. I had got married at a young age, a couple of kids, and getting this other job, this other career with the power company out here is kind of how I saw my life going. It was really set, you know, as far as finances and just everyday outside blue-collar job that I was loving. But when Mark got killed, you know, I can't really explain. Standing in front of my TV, I could still see it as clear as yesterday. I could see what I was wearing. I was standing 3 feet from the TV, and I was just so affected by his death in particular and what he was doing, why he was doing it. He had a six-month-old child at home and a wife that he left behind, and I just felt this calling to wear that uniform, honor his sacrifice, and to get out there and serve the community that I had grown up in.
Okay, so now we're come. So that's kind of like the backdrop of having or being inspired by somebody else that a bad thing happened, but it turned out to be a net positive for you in terms of doing what you always really want to do. And that is, as you said, serve your community. But, you know, that all changed 14 months later on that day, that night, March 26, 2001. So tell us what was going on. You're in your police car, and what happens?
Well, I'd started work at 3 in the afternoon. I'm supposed to work until 1 o'clock in the morning, 10-hour shift. About 11:30 that night, I was very quiet, kind of a boring day. There wasn't a lot going on. And about 11:30 that night, there was an emergency call, and it actually was not in my area. You know, Phoenix is a very large city, a lot of police officers, and you have your dedicated patrol zones, and it was really nowhere close to my patrol zone. So I kind of ignored the call at first when I heard it, and then the officers that are busy at the time, so the dispatcher came back on, repeating the details of the call. It was an emergency call. It sounded like something very serious, something important. And I allowed another brief few seconds to go by. When I didn't hear somebody answer for it, I chose to grab the radio and I said, I'll head that direction. And so lights and siren, I've got long ways to travel, emergency call, get there as quick as I can. And as I approached a intersection about 5 minutes east of downtown Phoenix, very busy part of the valley, one of the freeway overpasses right there, several hospitals, well, Phoenix Children's Hospital, Arizona Heart Institute, those kind. It's a busy part of town. And when you're running what we call Code 3, lights and siren, if you have a red light, you still have to come to a complete stop to make sure that people are getting, you know, seeing you from the other directions are going to yield to your vehicle. And it only takes a second and a half to clear an intersection. And just as I was going to proceed, my patrol car was struck from behind by a taxi cab, and something that you could probably relate to will hit home with you. The gentleman who hit me was in the middle of a grand mal epileptic seizure. And, you know, looking back, I don't know, most likely attracted to my overhead lights is all I can assume. I obviously was not targeted. He had made a lot of mistakes. He had done a lot of things wrong. He ended up going to prison. That's a whole other story, but he hit me and he was doing 115 miles an hour. So my car, I don't remember the crash. I mean, I wasn't looking in my rearview mirror, and that kind of an impact at that speed, of course, you're going to be knocked. You're an NFL player. How many times you get your bell rung and you get.
Oh, it's like Ronnie Lott. I've been hit by him and that's not fun.
There you go. So yeah, again, a beautiful blessing though. I was knocked unconscious. So you get to erase the fear, you get to erase the chaos, you get to erase any of those memories. And even more importantly, my car burst into flames. It traveled 270 feet through the intersection, and miracle upon miracle, twists of fate. You can put a lot of labels on it, but I came to rest 50 feet from a fire truck. And I can't begin to tell you all the things that went into the timing of putting a fire truck in the exact intersection at the exact moment that I needed them most. They were able to turn their truck, drive over there, and go to work for me.
Incredible. Incredible. So now you're in this car. Did you have a partner in the car with you, or were you solo?
I was solo at the time. And had there been anybody else in it, you know, the back seat, the back of the car was... there was almost 7 feet of crush on the rear of my car, and the gas tank obviously ruptured and gasoline poured in, and those little sparks in a car accident doesn't take much to spark a fire. But from what the firefighter said, the flames were so intense, they were licking the bottom of the freeway overpass. I mean, this car was fully engulfed, and yeah, I was trapped inside in my seatbelt. And these firefighters, they've all got very important specific jobs to do. There's only four on a truck, and you know, the captain might be given incident details, trying to get more units on scene. The engineer was getting her truck prepped, getting the hoses out. One of them has to battle the blaze, try to shoot some pure oxygen across my face, give me a chance to breathe, which, back to being unconscious, I wasn't inhaling the smoke and fire in a desperate way, in a fearful way. Because I was unconscious, my breathing was very, very shallow, which was one of 10 things that I could list that actually saved my life. And this young rookie, along with a couple of police officers that happened to be very nearby, were able to get me out of the car in about 90 seconds. And you can see the damage that the fire will do in a brief amount of time.
Yeah. So hold the story there really quickly. Yeah. So, okay. So let me just, I want to just reset this just a bit. So you're in this car, this guy has an epileptic seizure. He's going 150 miles per hour. He hits you pretty much at a dead stop. You're a dead stop. He hits you going 150 miles. it like rams through the back of your car, and now your car bursts into flames. Upon impact, then you become unconscious, which actually turned out to save your life because you weren't taking these big inhaling, like trying to grab oxygen. And at the same time, this fire truck, who had to be 50 feet away, comes racing over, and they start whipping out the hoses and everything else. But I'm sure somebody was in there with a portable, and they're trying to spray that down while at the same time trying to unbuckle you to pull you out of the car. And during this whole time, while the car is erupting and just catching, what I read is that the fire, the heat blaze was going something like 700 degrees. I mean, it was just literally you're not supposed to survive something like this. I mean, it's just like, you know, putting a pizza in the oven and turning it as high as you can possibly go, and expecting, you know, I mean, it just doesn't, you know, those two things don't go along.
No, it doesn't happen. You don't survive things like this. And it took so many miracles. It took so many little pieces and little precious seconds and effort, different effort. One person could not help me. It took a lot of people to get me not only out of that car, but to what I'm going to argue is the best burn center in the United States at Maricopa County Hospital, on their trauma table in less than 8 minutes. For anybody out there who's a first responder or has been in a critical incident, you can understand, you know, they talk about the golden hour sometimes. We're talking from the time I was hit till I'm off the trauma table in an emergency room is 8 minutes. That's unbelievable. Nobody has that kind of luck, that kind of blessings on their side. So I give a lot of credit to what they must have gone through, the police officers seeing the car, thinking, can you imagine what they must have been thinking? Like, that's one of my friends in there who's dying right now, and they don't even know who it is, but they got a job to do. And going above and beyond the call of duty, doing something in that sense that those firefighters and cops did that night, that's not for everybody. I don't care what uniform you're wearing, what job you're doing. It's fight or flight syndrome is very real within all of us. So I still talk to all these individuals as often as I can. We're very close, and it had a deep impact on their lives, as you can imagine, life-changing for them, what they witnessed and did.
Yeah, so when you talk about witness, so now you get pulled out of this car and you're laying there, and I don't want to minimize this in any way, but from what I could see, I mean, you are literally just as charcoaled as somebody could be. I know that, you know, if I have a little burn or something on the oven, I grab a hot plate or something, that's a superficial thing. But I mean, this had literally gone down through your skin into your bone. And I can't imagine, like, you were obviously at near death at that point.
Yes.
But, you know, when they're actually pulling you and grabbing you, is your body not so fragile that, you know, like your skin, I mean, it's already like burned off. I mean, it's just like, it seems like you'd be so fragile that your arms would dislocate or something. I mean, to get you onto a table like that, it's just, how did that all work out in the way it did?
Yeah, I don't think I fully comprehend that either. You know, of course, in the chaos and the, no pun intended, but the heat of the moment, the first responders certainly weren't thinking anything like that. They were just, got to cut this guy's seatbelt. Like, we got to get him out. They were risking their own lives in the midst of this fire as well. I never even touched the ground. The ambulance pulled up right next to my car, and I basically body surfed across several hands from my car into the waiting ambulance. Then they had to go to work on getting a couple of IVs in me, get me intubated because I wasn't breathing. And so I don't think there was any thought into, well, we might tear off his skin, things like that. But, you know, I know for me with my injuries from the neck up, it was fourth degree, which, as you said, down last layers of muscle into the bone. My shoulders to my hands were third degree later, but probably in the initial stages, they were severe second degree. Burns will keep on burning until a doctor gets all of that dead bacteria filled tissue off of you. They will continue to get worse and deeper. So that's part of why burn survivors end up with severe scarring, because they have to remove everything if you have any hope of survival. So, you know, things were not coming off of me, or, you know, I was in very good shape. I was very strong, you know, 6'3", 200 pounds, very good shape. And because I was only in there for that limited time, I don't think my body had quite gotten to the point where it was going to fall apart.
I mean, it's weird. I mean, you can appreciate we're about the same dimension. And, you know, I say this all the time, preparation meets opportunity. And sometimes the opportunity, like in this case that you're talking about, you know, I mean, you were conditioning your body for other reasons, but as it turned out, it actually saved your life for something that you would never thought in a million years would have ever happened to you.
Yes. The catching on fire was the absolute last thing that I thought was going to happen. I mean, I prepared for getting into fights. I prepared for getting into foot pursuits. I prepared mentally, emotionally with my uniform for being in a shooting or getting stabbed or something that you just automatically think about in law enforcement. Being in a fire was not something that turned out later. Even my bulletproof vest was one of the major contributing factors in saving my life, because had my chest been burned the way my face was, absolutely no chance of survival. I would have died very, very quickly, because with the burns, they constrict. You can't breathe. Basically, your lungs wouldn't be able to expand. Well, my torso is unharmed because of that bulletproof vest.
Yeah, no, it's like you said, there's 10 miracles that happen along the way, and that's one of them, right?
Oh, yeah.
So now tell me what happened. So that is, you know, obviously it was awful at the time, but at the same time, you are unconscious. The car is bursting up in flames. It's these fellow firemen. I'm sure there's police on the scene as well. I mean, they are like living this nightmare that you haven't even woken up to yet. So now it's, you know, I don't know what the hours, the days, but you finally, you know, come out of this and you're bandaged and you're wrapped up and you're in the hospital and everybody's around you and they don't know if you're going to live or die. But at what moment were you sitting there just recognizing the severity of, like, this was a game changer, this is a life changer for you?
I realized it was a game changer right when I woke up from, I was placed into a medically induced coma. The doctors told my family, look, Jason is not going to live. There's no way to survive this. Never seen burns like this, somebody's head and face.
Yeah.
But we have to remove everything. We're going to place him into a medically induced coma just to spare him from the pain and the fear, and we need to keep him quiet. So they put me into that medically induced coma, and that lasted 2.5 months.
Yeah.
Now, a medically induced coma, not a head injury, I had a mild concussion, but with the medicine, it's the blink of an eye. So for me, from the time I was at work until I'm awake in the hospital, was like the blink of an eye. And when I started to get told, I mean, I recognized right away, there's something seriously wrong. I'm in a hospital. I can't move. I can't see anything. And I felt very, I mean, I'm sure you've had plenty of injuries in your career and in your life. Your body knows when it is injured. And there's a certain calm within the weakness that you're just like, all right, I just need to lay here and I just need to relax. And I felt that. So I knew right away something very bad. And as I was getting told, you know, you're in a car accident, your car caught on fire, and that was my biggest fear. So I was trying to process that, but not being able to see myself, not being able to feel the pain because of all the medicine. It took quite a while for me to fully comprehend. I think it was a little bit of a mixture of denial. Like, I know I'm blind. I'm 100% darkness I'm staring into. Claustrophobic, terrifying experience that I can't even describe. Yet, that in itself wasn't telling me the severity of what had happened. It's just amazing how our minds will work. And so it took me a while.
Yeah.
So, weeks to figure it out.
Just so for some clarification, because you and I we're doing a video chat right now. This will be played as an audio. So we're looking at each other. Do you have your full sight? Did that come back?
No, I currently do not have my full sight. They were able to get me back. I was blind, 100% blind for about 9 months, and it was due to they had actually covered my corneas with skin grafts because my corneas were severely damaged by the heat and fire.
Yeah.
And then through a lot of medical procedures, even using my own blood, as eye drops because your body heals itself so well. I was able to regain a lot of my sight where soft lenses and hard lenses in my eyes. And then over time, my right eye has scarred over on the cornea. Everything behind my corneas is great. And I'm not really a candidate right now for corneal transplant. So I've lost vision in my right eye, my left eye. I do wear a hard, specially made hard contact lens, and I see good enough to, I mean, I drive. I do my work on the computer and see my cell phone and watch TV, but it's definitely not great.
Yep. I saw it. Yeah. Okay. So,
no, not even close.
So you mentioned, I want to shift just a hair and then I want to come back. So when you are standing up at the altar and you say for better or for worse, and this, in this case, it's for worse, right? And so now 14 months after you joined the police force in San Diego, in Phoenix, it's March 26, 2001. And now you're, you know, in an induced coma for 2 months, and now you're coming out of this thing. What role in relationship to your wife play into all this? And, you know, what was she going through?
Well, I don't think I'll ever be able to fully understand or appreciate what she went through in those first couple of months while I was asleep. But again, we had two kids at the time. We had a 7-year-old daughter, and then we had a son who turned 3 while I was in my coma. So she had her hands full, and she had to make all the decisions based on, you know, what doctors were saying, things they wanted to try, whether it be putting special stuff on my open wounds, amputating fingers, wanting to amputate my entire hands. And she would have to go back and forth with what does she want? What does she think I would want? Make all these decisions, along with being a mom and juggling our finances and dealing with the news media that was all over it because I was in the line of duty. It was a very big story dealing with my other family, my parents, my siblings, and everybody's got an opinion when something like this happens. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And she was the sole decision maker. So, but for me, you know, when I woke up, she was the one who was in my room with me, and never forget how calm and strong her voice was right from the get go. And there was just never a doubt that she wanted me home, would do. She gave up a great career that she had and stayed home to take care of me in those initial days. I was, I finally went home after 5 months. And then the life transition really started. I mean, you talk about a mental and emotional adversity when you get home. I'm not in the hospital anymore. I'm not surrounded by all these professionals. And I've got two little kids who are pretty intimidated and pretty scared. My son didn't believe I was his dad. He's only 3 years old. And the innocence of the child, they didn't deserve to have their lives disrupted like this. So I give my wife just an immense amount of credit for what she did for those children and what she did for me those first several years.
You've got this great quote that is on your website. Sometimes the most beautiful, inspirational changes will disguise themselves as utter devastation. And your response to that is be patient. In other words, you know, through awful things, and this is what happened to me, and this is how, you know, I started a podcast, Finding Your Summit, right. People overcoming adversity to find a way. Yeah, I mean, that was me, right? And right. And that was my devastation, and I thought nothing could ever get worse. But sometimes you have to go through those moments because there's a greater cause that's waiting for you out there. You can't see it at the time, and you're hitting yourself, and, you know, it's just the blame game and all that kind of stuff. And until you kind of let all that stuff go, that you can really take on a new life. And something, again, that I also saw that you had mentioned that I really identified with is this whole concept of life, rebirth, and transformation. And so for you now, you know, you go through these different transformation, these phases of being in the car, having the car blown up, you're on fire, you're in the hospital for 2 months. Now you got to come home and you got two young kids and they can hardly even recognize you. And you're trying to come to grips with like your new appearance, you know, with burns. And so at what point in time does everything kick in for you where you're going to get motivated and you're getting inspired to not play the victim and to go out there and somehow or another make a difference and become a change agent to what you're doing today.
Well, it started thankfully very early for me when, you know, I consider myself very lucky that I didn't have to suffer the PTS. You know, I don't like the letter D at the end because I don't think it's a disorder, it's an injury, but I wasn't targeted. Somebody wasn't intentionally hurting me. He made a lot of bad decisions. And when I thought about myself, I thought I'd made a lot of very good choices. And I am the one who chose to be a police officer. I chose to answer a call that I had no business answering up for. And I can go back years and years of my life. I gave up a college golf scholarship to join the Air Force. I chose to only stay in the Air Force 4 years. I made all these decisions that had gotten me basically to that hospital, that got me that intersection. And instead of saying, you know, something happened magically, instantaneously, and why me, poor me, none of that is true, and none of it's going to do me any good. I need to be accountable. And when I recognized that, I understood that, okay, if all these choices got me here, then every choice I make starting right now will take me where I need to go. And, you know, of course, it was a lot of dark days. There was just so much fear, so much pain, so much, how are we going to get through this? How am I going to get through this? But the beautiful thing about positive momentum is once it gets going, it can be a powerful force if you just get out of the way and let it go. And I had a lot of little incremental things. I was very lucky to be a police officer and have my story positively portrayed. So I got a lot of support from the community. I carried the Olympic torch in January of 2002, not even a year after the accident, my first kind of public appearance. And
where was that? Where was that?
In Phoenix, on its way to Salt Lake City.
Yep.
And then that same year, October of 2002, my wife gives birth to our third child. Now we're talking, you talk about perspective. So all of a sudden, it's not about getting me out of the car. It's not about getting me through one or two surgeries. This is an entire life that shouldn't even exist. What if he grows up and has three or four children? What if they grow up and have three or four children? It has no logical end. The beauty of what took place is starting to really take shape for me. And part of why I came up with that quote that you mentioned, sometimes the most beautiful inspirational changes will disguise themselves as utter devastation. Be patient. Because all of these years later now, I'm not at all bothered by my appearance. I'm not at all bothered that I don't have 10 dexterous fingers or perfect eyesight. I'm not at all upset or regretful that I'm not a police officer anymore. Life is exactly where it should be, where I've chosen it to be. And I wouldn't trade it for anything. My kids are much better. They are incredible human beings, achieving individually, the three of them. It's amazing to see these children's lives right now. And what I'm doing with my public speaking, still involved with the police department, teaching at the academy. And I'm only 47 years old. I mean, I'm still a pretty young man. So that's where I came up with that quote. And obviously, I didn't feel it at the time, but I do now. And even like when you said yours, right away, I thought about, I could tell you so many things I relate to with when I look at what are my summits. And then I have a feat. You've done all this. I got invited just recently to go climb Mount Kilimanjaro this fall. And my initial thought is, how can I do it? I've got breathing problems because my nose is collapsed. My eyes are so delicate. Why would I take the chance of everything I've overcome going over to this foreign land and dying? But then there's such a part of me that's like, Jason, you can do this. You should do this because you'll never regret it. That's a summit. But my other summits, my kids, my health, my honoring, continuing to honor all the people who took care of me from that night, the firefighters, the police officers, my doctors. That's a summit for me. And I love what you're doing because I'm going to get off this podcast later and reflect on that heavily. Like, I will never stop trying to to reach those summits to make sure that people understand what they did for me was worth it. They helped me.
Yeah, no, I love everything you're saying, and we're relating to the same type of subject matter. You know, I've been talking to a close friend of mine who has gone through a little bit of a career shift and trying to figure out what that is, and so it sometimes you have to just go out there and reinvent yourself to create your new summit, and it's just not, you know, you're saying this, and I've said this before in the podcast. You know, it's called finding your summit, but it's really finding your summits and plural, because there's your married summit, there's your kid summit, there's your personal summit, there's things you have to overcome to that summit, you know, and life goes through, and if you're not growing, you're dying. And I really believe that. And I don't think I was really in that mode of challenging myself to new things, because I got comfortable with what I was comfortable with until about 10 years ago, you know, and I've said this before, but I would have never imagined some of the things that have happened in my life, but I wouldn't be a better person if I hadn't gone through some of the hell that I had to go through to get where I am. And the other thing that, you know, it's not going to be fun, but there's other bad stuff that's going to happen too.
It's coming.
It's coming. Yeah.
That is one guarantee. It is coming.
Yeah, it is coming. And, you know, I mean, going back to what we were talking before about your body, you know, about preparation, you know, meets opportunity, is the best thing you can do is put yourself in the best possible position to win. And when those things hit you on the left or the right, right down the middle, you know, they're going to hurt, but you have a better perspective on how you want to deal with those things as you move forward through life and navigate in a way that's a positive and not a net negative. And so then right. You go back again to your utter devastation comment and just be patient. But you also got to, I believe you have to be patient, but you also have to work that process.
Of course you do.
You know,
yes.
And then the other thing I really love what you said is when you tap into that positivity, momentum gets momentum. And once you turn that around, sometimes it's hard, but if you're not out there trying and fighting and helping and volunteering and doing all those different things, it's not going to happen. I can guarantee it. If you don't take a step forward up that mountain, it will never flip and happen, period.
That is exactly right. And if you can't see your finish line, if you can't see your goals or your outcome, if you at least take one or two steps forward, working towards something, you're going to see a little bit farther than you could two steps ago. So just keep doing that. And I did that from whether I was actually in darkness all the way to the fears and the anxiety. And we mentioned a few minutes ago, adversities always forming ways to come at us. Life is meant to live, and it happens to us all. It's not about, we're not all going to catch on fire. We're not all going to play in the NFL. We're not all going to have children with diseases. We're not all going to, life happens to all of us, but the one guarantee is it is nonstop that life is going to try and take you out mentally, spiritually, physically, emotionally. And the fight that is so worth having is how do you not let one of those get too far down? How do you not let it get bankrupt in one of those sections? You know, you're feeding this one side, whether it's your spiritual side or your mental side, and then, oh no, I've let my, you know, my physical side or my emotional side go. You got to continue that balance, but it might not be easy, but it is always worth it. It's just always worth it. So I'm a better person. You say you're, for all the hell you've gone through, you're a better person. I promise you, at 47 years old right now, if I was still a cop, had never gone through adversity, I would be nowhere close to the man I am today. And I am damn proud of who I am, how I look, and what I've got coming my way in the future, good and bad.
So let's talk about your public speaking. So out of the ashes, so to speak, right. You know, right? You've like emerged as this beautiful person that's going around, and you know, it is inspirational because there's just too many people out there that give up. And I got to tell you too, because my life's not perfect. And one of the things that I love to do is I listen to a lot of other people's podcasts because I need to get jacked up too. I need people to like, you know, throw some perspective because, you know, I train here in Sun Valley. I go up and down this mountain every day and I'm trying to do, and I'm, you know, I'm going to give Everest my best shot and I'm going to, but I can't, you know, every single day I'm not at my best. I can tell you that. And I have to get, you know, I need some little motivator to get me going. And then things come up and they distract you and everything else. So when you're going around and you're talking to people around the country, you do over 70 events over the year. Congratulations to that. Yeah, no, it's amazing. You know, what do people typically, the message that you're trying to instill other people as they come and listen to you?
I try to instill in people, first of all, that life is about choices. And as we sit here in an audience, you know, I could be in there with 50 people. I've spoken to thousands of people at the same time. Everybody's got a story. Everybody has gone through things in life that have tried to take them out. And here we all are in this room. So I talk a lot about choices. I talk a lot about accountability, a lot about attitude and mindset and all those things. But I'm also very vulnerable. You know, this is not just a roadmap of like, hey, if you're involved in fire, this is how you might handle it. It's more about just having a little bit of a perspective, giving yourself a little bit of a break. You said it just about perfect. This is what I talk about. When you lay your head down on the pillow at night and you're alone with your thoughts, I don't care who's next to you, you're alone. And our minds are pretty crazy and pretty powerful, the thoughts. But usually you're thinking about, when you lay down at night, are you thinking about how perfect and wonderful life is? No, you're thinking about your adversity, whether it be climbing Mount Everest, whether it be something that your children are going through, or your own health, or a regret you have from a decision you made 10 years ago. You think about things like that, and the weight of the world kind of lays down on top of you. But when you wake up in the morning, it's the most inherent desire that we have as human beings. It's a beautiful thing. You wake up and you're like, I want to be inspired. Something moved me. Something made me feel good. And it's different for all of us. Like you, I like to listen to podcasts, or I'll throw on a song that is what I need at the moment. And it could be this crazy, thunderous motivational song, or it could be a sad heartbreak song. Whatever I need to get me motivated and understand as you roll through the day, it's probably not going to go how you plan. I mean, things are going to pop up that you're not expecting, and you got to get through that. And then the process starts all over again that night. But if you have a simple goal every day, this is kind of how I live. I get up every morning and get my wife off to work, my kid off to school. I only have one kid at home now. He's in high school, and the other two are off to college. But whether I'm traveling, speaking, I have a simple little goal. I'm going to leave today better than I found it. Whether that's the grocery store, putting an extra cart away, opening the door for somebody, the gas station, a meeting, a phone call, a podcast, a speech with 1,000 people. But when I get in bed at night and I close my eyes and I'm alone with my thoughts, I'm simply going to ask myself, is today better than you found it in your backyard, in your world? And if you say yes, you will see and feel a positive shift in your life like you can't believe. And that's just a simple everyday motivator for me that I'm not going to give in, as far as I'm not going to treat the world bad. I'm not going to treat you bad. I'm not going to treat a business bad because I'm having a bad day. And I'm human. I get angry. I have a temper. I have anxiety. I shed tears. I have plenty of fears about the future. I stress about my kids nonstop. And I thought that went away after they grew up. Apparently it gets worse. But when you have that goal, it's amazing what it's done for me. And so I try to pass that on to people to, you know, meet yourself where you are, feel what you're feeling, but don't give up the fight and find other people that will inspire you. Find other people that will motivate you and try to learn how did they do that? Let me use part of their instruction manual and apply it to what I've got. Everything you need, no matter what your adversity is, whoever's listening out there, we all have exactly what we need to get past things. It's our choice to see them and use them instead of just giving up and taking the, I hate to say the easy way out, but that is what's easy. Giving up, saying I can't, not staying motivated, those all come easy. The other parts that are hard, they're the ones that are worth it.
Well, yeah, I love everything you just said. It's inspirational. We all need it. And I think, you know, for me at least, it's all those things ring true. And the one thing then after all said and done is taking that action and moving forward in whatever you need to do to create a better life for yourself and those people around you. And it's just always inspiring, you know, when people around you, again, they see improvement and they seem, you know, like this aura that you're carrying around, this light, and it's infectious, right? People like to be around positive people.
It is infectious.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's great. So listen, where can people find you?
I have a website is burningshield.com. My book is Burning Shield. It's available on Amazon. My crazy last name, if you type in Jason Schechterle, a ridiculous amount of stuff will come up on the internet. I am very easy to get a hold of and be found, whether it's somebody wanting to have a private conversation about what they're going through or whether it's somebody wanting to book me for a speech on Twitter and Instagram and LinkedIn. I post a lot of things. Like to stay active, like to show people what I'm doing. And yeah, I'm pretty easy to find and get a hold of.
Awesome. 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 So it's called The Burning Shield, the book and the website. So incredible. Listen, I think you've made me a better person today. I always get inspired by these people like you that shed a different way, that they live their life, things that they've gone through. And again, it just helps me process, you know, where I need to go and what I'm still trying to achieve. And that's been a blessing for me as I've kind of fought through this and started, you know, this whole podcast world. Because it's led to a lot of introductions and access to people like you. So thank you for that. Okay, so on that note, I appreciate it. This will come out in a few weeks. I look forward to broadcasting this to the world and getting your message out there to everyone. It needs to be heard. And for all that, I am very appreciative. Thank you.
I deeply appreciate the opportunity, and I wish you the best of luck in the future. And on that climb, I will be thinking about you and rooting for you.
Thank you, buddy. I really appreciate it. Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Okay.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Owning a home is full of surprises. Some wonderful, some not so much. And when something breaks, it can feel like the whole day unravels. That's why HomeServe exists. For as little as $4.99 a month, you'll always have someone to call. A trusted professional ready to help, bringing peace of mind to 4.5 million homeowners nationwide. For plans starting at just $4.99 a month, go to HomeServe.com. That's HomeServe.com. Not available everywhere. Most plans range between $4.99 to $11.99 a month your first year. Terms apply on covered repairs.